Today is August the 28th, 1975, and we are talking today with Britton Turkle, an Alliance native currently residing in New York City, who is quite well known in the United States as an author of children's books and an illustrator of children's books. And Britton, I thought we'd start off by talking a little bit about some of the books that you have written and illustrated yourself. Can we start with the Obadiah series?
Yes. You want a list of them?
Yes. How many books are in that series so far?
There are three Obadiah books, and the first book I wrote was Obadiah the Bold, and I think at the time I only thought there would be one book that I'd ever write. I never expected there to be two other Obadiahs, and I think five other books, including the one that is now in a publisher's office waiting for me to work on.
How exciting. we'll come to that one later on. Obadiah series started out with Obadiah the Bold, and then the next one was
Thy Friend Obadiah, and the last one is The Adventures of Obadiah.
And I think Rodman Library right away would like to point out that we're very fortunate to be the home for the original illustrations for each of those books, and Obadiah a home.
I'm glad Obadiah has a home.
These books are about a little Quaker boy.
Mm-hmm.
And since we know that you have Quaker as your background currently,
mm-hmm.
right, that seems to tie in. But I'm wondering how, since it was the first book that you had written yourself, how did you happen to meet Obadiah?
Obadiah first appeared on a Valentine to a little girl. I had been staying with this little girl's parents, visiting them in Chicago. They were old friends of mine. And when I got back to New York, I sent the little girl a Valentine because it was close to Valentine's Day, and I put on it a little Quaker boy with red hair and, of course, his gray clothes, and holding behind his back, rather shyly, he had a big Valentine, a big piece of paper with a heart on it. In the middle of the heart was written, presumably by him, "Will thee be mine?" And from that moment, I had a feeling that there must be a story in this little boy. And I went to Philadelphia on a visit once, hoping I'd find a story there, because he was an old-fashioned Quaker boy, and the first place I thought of for an old-fashioned Quaker was Philadelphia. But he didn't live there, because I found out nothing about him there at all, and pretty much gave up on the idea of getting a story on him. About 2 years later, I went on a visit to Nantucket. I hadn't wanted to go to Nantucket at all. I wanted to go to Block Island, but by the time I was able to get to Block Island, I couldn't get there by public transportation without spending 2 days getting there and 2 days getting back, and I wanted this to be a weekend. So instead, I flew up in a rather bad temper to Nantucket. And the minute I got into this charming little town, I realized that I was in a very special place indeed, because it hasn't changed very much over 200 years. They've tried very hard to keep it as it used to be, and it was essentially a Quaker community from the mid-17th century, or from its first settlement, actually, by white people, until about 1850. And in the 18th century, I would say that 90% of the people on that island were Quakers, so it was essentially a Quaker community. And the houses looked like Quaker houses. They were gray shingle as they got weather-beaten, and white trim, and looked like they were made by ship's carpenters, as indeed they were, of many of the old ones. And the streets were cobblestone streets, and I fell instantly in love with Nantucket, prowled around the town, and stayed in an old 18th century inn, a little place called the Woodbox. And I was upstairs in my room one night after eating too much lobster, and woke up in the middle of the night with a stomachache and a story about a little boy in a telescope. A little boy who was quite fearless and then got frightened, and then, the whole story is about him wanting to be a pirate. That whole idea came to me at that time, and I wrote it down, and I believe his name originally was Jeremiah or something in that original transcript. But after I got to New York, I took this back with me and worked on it a little bit, and asked Ezra Jack Keats, who was the author of The Snowy Day and a friend of mine, if he would read it to see what he thought of it. If he liked it, then I would put it send it to a publisher. Ezra was most enthusiastic about it and insisted I send it to his publisher, which at that time was the Viking Press. I sent it to them, and since the manuscript was only about 10 pages, it seemed to me that the editor could read it in about 10 minutes. But I was deciding to give her a week. In a month, I hadn't heard. And finally got in touch with the editor, and she said that she had given it a brief reading and wanted to discuss it with me, but she was concerned about the ending, which didn't seem to work out for her somehow. I quickly reread my carbon copy and sat down and wrote a new ending for it and sent it to her, and she got it and said she was grateful for it and that she would let me know in a week. It was about another month before I finally was called in. And at this time, I'd almost given up on the idea of it being published. But she talked with me. Her name was Annis Duff, and she was a very gentle and a very amiable lady indeed. And she began talking about various parts of the story, and I thought she was going to give me pointers about how to write another story. But this was not the story that they were going to publish. But she began talking about details of it, and she called in the production man of the publishing house to talk about the way the book might be printed, the illustrations, and how I thought the illustrations ought to be done. And suddenly it began to dawn on me that they wouldn't be going to this trouble if they didn't want to publish it. So tentatively I said, well, does this mean that you want to publish my book? And Anna Stuff said, oh yes, just like that. And I had always thought that at this magic moment, fireworks would go off, bells would ring, and sirens would scream. I never thought it would happen with a simple, quiet, oh yes.
She took it so casually.
Mm-hmm.
What a marvelous story. Then you followed that one with Thy Friend Obadiah, and now there have been the Adventures of Obadiah.
That's right. Now, these didn't happen consecutively.
No.
Right after the Obadiah the Bold came another book called The Magic of Millicent Musgrave, and then another book called The Fiddler of High Lonesome. And then I think the sequence followed that Thy Friend Obadiah came next. And then there was a book called The Sky Dog, Mooncoin Castle, and then I think the other Obadiah, the third one,
The came. Adventures of Obadiah.
Now, the second Obadiah stories came as a direct result of the first one, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The second one has to do with Obadiah's a relationship with a seagull, which adopts him, much to his disgust.
Yes.
And that happened as a result of my first trip there, because I saw a seagull in distress on the docks of Nantucket on that trip, and he had a, he or she, I don't know why seagulls are always he, but the seagull person, had a fisherman's bobber wound around his beak, and it looked to me like this seagull wasn't going to be able to feed properly and was not going to live long with this, and I would have given anything to have been able to remove that from this poor creature's beak. But of course you couldn't get near them. You couldn't get within 10 yards of them before they fly off. And in this story, where this plight of this poor seagull worried me long afterwards, and in this story I have the seagull being helped by Obadiah, and since seagulls are very wild creatures, I thought maybe this could be a very peculiar seagull that had adopted Obadiah first, that made the first friendly overtures to the boy, which would mean that he could then approach the seagull and relieve it of its distress, and that's what that story is about.
Let's talk now. We've mentioned the first two Obadiah books. How about the third book, The Adventures of Obadiah?
That came about directly as a result of research for the first two books. After all, I'd only spent 3 days in Nantucket before the first Obadiah story came out. And so I felt it was important, if I was going to make other books about this Starbuck family on Nantucket, to know about traditions of the Quakers and more about the history of Nantucket. And I did a lot of research in New York. I went back to Nantucket and investigated old records to find out the life of the Quakers in 1805, which is actually the date of these stories. The third book is about Obadiah going to a picnic, which is called a squantum. Squantums were big family affairs that everybody went to, which centered around a sheep shearing event that took place every year. It seemed to be the big social event of the year, and everybody went to these things. It was about 3 or 4 miles outside of the town of Nantucket, and they go to these sheep shearings and have picnics, and the more worldly people, the sailors and people coming from off-island, would go to a sideshow. Sideshows would certainly have been out of bounds to any Quaker family. And it's brought out in this story that they are going to the squantum, but they are certainly not going to the sideshow. Obadiah gets there. And the way he gets there is in the back of a sheep that breaks loose from this enclosure. That is what I actually read about happening in some of the history of the island. Sheep seemed to roam all over the island pretty much willy-nilly throughout the year, and they were rounded up in the spring or summer, rather, for the sheep shearing. And one of them did actually get loose and careen all over the town. So in my story, Obadiah happens to be on the back of the sheep, and the sheep tosses him literally into the sideshow. So he has an experience nobody bargained for in this thing, and when he tells it to them, they can't believe it because nobody's ever had the experience of being in one. The story, however, is verified, and as somebody pointed out later, that this book follows very much the story, the Aesop fable of the boy who cried wolf. I recognized that as I began working on it, but that wasn't the impetus at all. The impetus came from the research.
And then makes it even more realistic, because it is a documented story. I don't think many people realize how much research is put into a book. This is true in some of the other books you've done, too.
Yes, I seem to like historical backgrounds, and I've used historical backgrounds in other books I've done. And illustrated, I've done two books about Benjamin Franklin, for instance, and these have required enormous research, which is usually quite terrifying to me, and I every now and then think I ought to give up doing historical books because they're such a headache. But there's something about them I like doing, or I wouldn't continue.
Let's talk about some of the other books that you've written and illustrated. The next one that comes to mind is Fiddler of High Lonesome. It's so different from the Obadiah books.
Yes. When I was a child, I had a series of books called The Book House, which were anthologies of stories and biographies, history, for various age levels. And I got one volume of it, and I gave it to my own children to read. Going through that book, I came across a story that I had read years ago by Joaquin Miller. This is a contemporary of Bret Hart's and Mark Twain's, who is practically unread today. But he was recounting something about frontiersmen going across the Rockies in a wagon train, stopping off and camping somewhere in the mountains, and around the fire in the evening being entertained by a fiddler who, it turns out, also is entertaining the bears who are dancing in the bushes. They find this out. And I don't remember any more of the story than that, but that set me to thinking. And I decided the story sort of came from that. I decided to put it in the southern mountains, which bothered me that it seemed that this was the right thing, right format for the story. And very often what seems to be the right thing for a story does not seem the right thing to me. I didn't want to do anything about the southern mountains. I certainly, as the thing developed, didn't feel that it should be in dialect, because I had a prejudice against dialect. But the story took its own way, as all stories do, and decided it wanted to be in the southern mountains and wanted to be in dialect, so I got busy and worked on dialect, doing again research for the writing on that, going back to Mark Twain and Bret Hart, early stories that supposedly were written by Davy Crockett, but this is, he never did write any stories. I don't know where these are sort of part of American legend now. But I developed my own dialect for this, and I feel that I have gotten away with it, because I've had people from the South say, People in Kentucky say that sounds like the people talk in Tennessee. People in Tennessee say that's the way people talk in Kentucky. But it is my own dialect.
Oh, so you didn't sit down with a tape recorder and listen to some Southerner speak. You
No.
simply created the dialect yourself.
No, but now that you mention tape recorder, that has been a very important tool in my work, because since most of my stories are picture books, which mean that they are to be read to children, the way they sound is extremely important, and so I try out the sound of them on tape before putting them down.
Marvelous.
At least I write first, then I read it into a tape recorder to see how it sounds, and if it sounds right, then I'll transcribe it and put it down again.
How about some of the other books that you've written? I think the background on Mooncoin Castle is interesting, because it is not set in the United States at all, is it?
No, that comes out of a love affair with Ireland. I went to Ireland just as I went to Nantucket and fell in love with Nantucket. I went to Ireland and fell in love with that. And I met a perfectly charming gentleman in Waterford, Ireland, who took me around and showed me around that part of Ireland, including a trip to the Rock of Cashel, which is one of the great monuments in Ireland. It's the seat of early Christendom there. And on the way, this man, whose name was William Glynn, who was a retired headmaster of a school, a Quaker school, by the way, in Waterford, he took me to a castle where we had lunch, and it was a ruined castle. And I was so ecstatically happy in this ruined courtyard in this beautiful, beautiful October day, sitting against the warm stones and listening to jackdaws all around and watching the swans out on the Brown River in front of the castle, that it wasn't long after that that I decided I wanted to write a story about an Irish castle. The original idea for that was to be a picture book about the building of a castle and the various tenants that would live there over a long period of time, the decline and decay of the castle, and eventually its restoration. This would be in a picture book format. But before I was very far into it, I discovered I had a ghost in mind, a jackdaw for a hero, and a witch, and some magic, and all sorts of things going on that did not fit into a picture book format. So when I got back to the United States and found this extraordinary tale in my possession and didn't know quite what to do with it, I realized I needed again research about the tearing down of the castle, because that's an important part of that book. So I wrote to William Glynn, my friend in Waterford, who had been the chairman of the local restoration of old landmarks in Ireland. It's this National Trust Society or something, and they're trying in Ireland, as they are every place else, I think, to keep the old landmarks, keep them from being torn down and turned into supermarkets or parking lots or gasoline stations. I think they call them petrol stations.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, I wanted to know what means one would go about to try to save an old castle, so I asked William Glynn for information and had quite a lengthy list of questions I wanted to answer. I also told him that I liked his Irish name, which is Liam, L-I-A-M, and he preferred to be called Liam rather than William. And I said I liked his name Liam so much that I would like to name one of the characters in my book Liam. I got a marvelous letter from him, a full 3 or 4 page letter, typewritten, starting out with, "So I am to be in a book, am I? Then I had best put on a bold face and hold back nothing." Whereupon he told me everything I wanted to know in that marvelous letter. So that helped me enormously with that book. And that is the oldest, for the oldest level, for the oldest children that I've written.
Mm-hmm. How about the books now that you have illustrated for other authors? I think the one that seems to be so popular in alliance with Alliance Children is Mr. Blue.
Yes, that was an early book. I think that has to be about 12 or 13 years old. That was, of course, before I began writing, and I don't know how to account for its popularity, except it does seem to appeal to children, and it is great fun. I have illustrated so many books that I literally have lost track of them, because I've been doing this for a long time. I tell people that I'm a young author, but a very old artist.
Let's talk about some of the other ones you've illustrated. You mentioned the Ben Franklin. Now, you did a you illustrated the biography of Ben Franklin that
That's
was written
right.
by Eve Miriam.
By Eve Miriam, yes.
And that came first.
That came first, and that's pretty much a straight biography, which I liked very much in the reading, and I think it's an interesting book and very well done, at least from Eve Miriam's standpoint, if not mine. But the more interesting one for me was Poor Richard in France, because this has a wrinkle to it, the wrinkle being that this gives you an insight in Ben Franklin as seen by his grandson, Benji, or Benny, who accompanied him to Paris when Ben went to raise funds for the American Revolution. Nobody quite knows why Ben took his grandson with him, because it must have been an extremely dangerous trip to take on this little tiny wooden boat crossing the Atlantic. Had they been caught by the British, the boat would certainly have been sunk, or they would have been captive. But at any rate, they got over there safely, and Ben, this story of his raising the money for the revolution is as told by a rather precocious young 7-year-old Benjamin.
Interesting, very interesting. And most of the tales in this are more of a fictional nature, are they not? Then
In
it
the
has
Poor
a
Richard?
fictional touch,
Yes,
yes, to
because
it.
of course nobody knows very much about the child Benny. I don't know that he ever reached maturity. He certainly never read and wrote anything about his grandfather, but everything in that book, all the facts are there.
Documented,
Yes.
but yet it
So,
has a
yeah.
fictional overtone
And I
to it.
think it's certainly, if Benny had written about his grandfather and if he loved him, this is what he would have written.
And another book that you've illustrated that it has historic tale to it is Ballad of William Sycamore. Of course, it is a poem
That's right.
by Stephen Vincent Benet.
And it was the editor at Little Brown, having seen some of the historical things I had done, thought I would be the right person to illustrate this book. And I found it an interesting sort of thing to do. Again, there was historical research involved because this is frontier America. And it is the second poem that I have illustrated, the second classic. No, that was the first one. The
First
second
one.
one was the Thanksgiving book.
Very good. And I think before we leave Ballad of William Sycamore, we have to point out the interesting review that it had in one of the reviewing media, and this was Booklist. I found it interesting that the reviewer there commented on the violence of the illustrations. Do you. I thought it was interesting because of your Quaker background, and I can't think of a less violent person or someone who would, under no circumstances, construe something to be violent in his drawings.
Well, maybe I got some subconscious aggression out in that thing, but I'm certainly not aware of it. And I don't think, never for one minute, that I want to glorify violence. There is William Sycamore's one son dies, I think, in the Alamo, and the other with Custer. And I did show a rather large dramatic scene of the one son being shot, but it's in the poem. I didn't make it up.
Yes, and
And
it
I
was.
don't think it's William Sycamore saying, "Isn't this a great thing? My son got killed."
No, it was just part of the story and part of the times in which they
Yes.
lived. It was a very fine poem, but I thought that was an interesting comment in the
Yeah.
review. Then the other one you mentioned that is a poem that you've illustrated is Over the River and Through the Wood,
Yes, which
correct?
is the most recent one,
Yes.
and has turned out to be possibly the most successful or popular book that I have ever done, illustrated or written. And of course, I didn't write that. This was written in 1840
By.
by Lydia Maria Child. And when the editor at Coward McCann called me, he was very excited because I had illustrated Poor Richard in France, which was written by him, although he didn't publish it. His house was interested in this Over the River and Through the Wood, the Thanksgiving poem. He thought I could do it. He wanted to send me the poem, and I read it and thought, this cannot be illustrated. But I thought it over a good deal, and he seemed to be so enthusiastic about it. I worked on it a little bit, and then he called me up and said he had just checked with the Library of Congress and found that there were six verses that hadn't been printed for about 100 years that were part of the original poem. And he sent them to me very happily, wanting to know whether I wanted them in this poem. And at first I didn't. One reason was because it had what I thought was one of the worst rhymes I had ever heard of in it, and I thought that Lydia Maria Child's muse had abandoned her in this one thing, which I thought was forgettable. Old Bowser the dog, or Towser the dog, in the farmhouse, as the family drives into the sleigh, she has written, he raises his pow and says bow wow. Well, I thought she couldn't get a rhyme for paw or bow wow, and so she made this, which I thought was really inexcusable of her. But I decided to let the whole thing go and would print the whole thing, even though I didn't approve of her poetry. I found out later that I was quite wrong and that Mrs. Child was quite right, because in Webster's Dictionary, pow is a rather archaic expression for head. And in that time, in 1840,
it would have been understood. Yes.
And understood. So I became a little more humble after that, I hope.
And the book did get published with your illustrations. I think the illustrations in Over the River, and I think in the Ballad of William Sycamore, and the Obadiah series are noteworthy not only for the beauty of them, but also for the warm family scenes. There's something very joyous, very comfortable in the family scenes that you do in these books.
Well, don't ask me to be objective about what I do, because I can't. People say they can recognize my style. I can't recognize my style. This is all very unconscious, I think. Mm-hmm. I appreciate those things. I would like to mention, however, before we leave the Thanksgiving poem, which was originally called a New England Boy's Thanksgiving, I think was its original title. It was a New England setting. And I've kept it New England except for one glaring inconsistency, and that is a house in Alliance, which is the Hartzell house. I had a picture of it, and it was exactly the right period, and it seemed to be exactly the right kind of a townhouse for the family to set out from to go to grandfather's house. So that's it.
And you know, it's interesting. Now, the people who are reading your book who are not from Alliance, I'm sure do not recognize that that's a home that was built in Alliance, Ohio, and find that it fits in well with the New England setting. The people from Alliance recognize the Hartzell Museum right away, and then look in the other New England buildings for other buildings from Alliance.
Yeah. No, it's the only one. But I think that it's legitimate. This was, after all, the Western Reserve, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
And this was highly influenced by New England, and I have done research on New England architecture, and that house could certainly have fit in Lynn, Massachusetts, or any place.
And, of course, it makes us in Alliance very proud to know that we have something we can recognize in the book, too. How about things you're working on now? You had mentioned that you just have a manuscript or a book with the publisher. Do you want to give us any indication of what is to be coming new from your work?
Yes. This book, I haven't signed the contract for it. I'll do that as soon as I return to New York. It's going to be a picture book. It's a book that I edited the words out of altogether and working on the story and simplifying it, because it's a very simple story and I don't want to go into it at this point. But it suddenly occurred to me that maybe it could be told by pictures alone. And I believe in editing, taking out anything that isn't really essential. And if the words weren't essential, then I wasn't going to leave them in. The words didn't seem to be essential. And so I developed it as a picture story. And
this would be, then, a picture book in the true sense of the word, where
yes.
the pictures tell the entire story.
That's right.
Oh.
So it's a book I kind of unwrote. Coming up this... for this Christmas will be an illustrated edition, which I did not write or rewrite, of the old Grimm fairy tale, The Elves and the Shoemaker. And that is in full color, and that was a book that was actually illustrated twice. I illustrated it twice, and the first time we got into some problems. I don't know whether this is the time to go into it or not. But did you hear about the naked elves?
No.
Well, the elves and the shoemaker in this grim story, the elves come and make the shoemaker shoes for him, and the author had written that they were naked. So I made them naked, being very discreet about their nakedness, but nonetheless they didn't have clothes on. And when the illustrations were finished, the editor got cold feet and said they couldn't possibly have this, because it was for Scholastic Magazine Press, that none of the parochial schools would ever allow this thing to be in their school system, and that they couldn't use them. And I pointed out that I had only followed the story, and they said yes, they realized it, but they would have to either be not done or I'd have to do it again. So we made a new contract on it, and it was redone. It's the only book I've ever had that kind of an experience with.
And do you feel happy with these
yes,
now that they're closed?
Yes, they're it's changed around considerably, but they've got rags on now, discreetly covering them.
Well, I'm sure in the old fairy tale and folktale literature you could find them either way.
Also, coming out in the spring is another book I illustrated for a Northwest author. about an island in the Puget Sound area off Vancouver Island. And it was so specific a location that I was asked by the publisher to go there and do research on that. So it will be a fairly factual, almost documentary of the San Juan Islands.
But certainly done and illustrated by an artist who's seen the area.
That's right.
In other words, you've had your trip there.
Yes.
Marvelous. Let's talk a little bit about how you managed to get into the world of children's books. This was not in your background originally. How does one get to be a children's author and artist?
Well, it was and it wasn't in my background. I was fortunate because I was given children's books to read, and I didn't really discover your library until I was practically in high school, because I was given books, and some of the books I enjoyed most happened to be written by a very good friend of my mother and father's, an Alliance resident named Gertrude Ellis Kay. And she was really the only person in Alliance that had any real feeling for art, and a person that I felt comfortable with. And going to her studio was one of the most exciting things I can remember of my days as a young boy in Alliance. These trips to the studio were fairly infrequent because Gertrude wasn't in Alliance a lot. She traveled a great deal. And she was a very busy woman indeed, and nothing would have pleased me more than to have had her as a teacher. And I believe my mother even asked her if she would consider teaching me, but she said she wasn't a teacher, and I know now what she means, because I had a very abortive career as a teacher myself and discovered I'm not a teacher either. You either have it or you don't. And she didn't. She recognized she didn't have it, but she did have me to her studio, and I always thought if I could just watch her work sometime, I could pick up the secrets of being an artist. I always liked to draw, and I think almost from the beginning thought I would like to draw in books because I love books so much. Mm-hmm. And it seems only absolutely right and fitting that loving words and pictures, I should be doing this professionally now as a children's book author and artist.
What careers did you get started in before you got around to getting to this one that hit home so well?
Well, I flirted with the theater for a while. In high school, I'd gotten involved in dramatic club and senior class play, and thought that was pretty exciting. And I went to Carnegie Tech, which is now Carnegie Mellon, I believe, in Pittsburgh, and studied theater there until I discovered that there were really more starving actors and starving artists. Whereupon I changed. I went to art school, and from then on, it was children's books. Although I had about 10 years in advertising first, simply because I couldn't get into publishing, and it took a long time to get into publishing. I had to come in by way of textbooks. And then in books for older children, until finally I have got to the middle-aged children, which is a peculiar name for the bracket of children before teenage and after picture book age. And then eventually I came down to my level, which is, I think, the picture books.
Do you find it sometimes difficult to explain to people that you have come down to your level, you say, and that they expect you someday to be grown up again?
Yes, I get this all the time. It's as if I've got to graduate from kindergarten sometime. But people don't realize that kindergarten is where I belong.
Well, people don't realize that such research as you've talked about goes into these picture books. They think that because they're written for children, they were written by a child, and it just isn't true.
Well, I have a very strong feeling about this. I think it's a tremendous privilege to be working with children, because children's minds are flexible like no one else's. As we get older, we solidify, we get into ruts, into stultifying ways of thinking, and children are open, and I believe that reading has a greater influence on children than it has on adults. And if I can touch a child's mind, and I know from time to time, this to me is what it's all about.
And I think there are hundreds of children's librarians that would say hurrah to that and agree with you heartily. I think you talked about some of the experiences that a children's author and illustrator has in an article you did for Publishers Weekly. Do you recall mm-hmm. that? Confessions of a Leprechaun, where people asked you, are you going to grow up and write adult books someday?
No, I keep getting that all the time. And people think it's a little odd that you would not to go to the big time. Well, to me, children's books are the big time.
Well, and may they so continue to be. You had mentioned some of the scenes of Alliance that were in your book, Over the River and Through the Wood, and that would be the Mabel Hartzell Museum.
That's right. It's kept in another book, and the most recent one that the one I wrote, which is It's Only Arnold, and this is, in a way, the most autobiographical book I've written. I have included in it not exact replicas, but certainly influences from my home on Union Avenue, the house next door to it. It is now occupied by the dean of Mount Union College. I used to roam around the backyards, which that house is the one neighboring house to my family home. And so as a child, I was wandering all around this area, and that area is in the book. Also, the front porch of our house on Union Avenue is in there. And I have put people I know in pictures. I even put myself in a picture once in a book called The Sky Dog.
Yes, but let's identify that. That's a scene in the book where a gentleman is perusing some books,
yes, it's
paperback
a,
books.
Yes, it's in a store, a general store at a beach and at a resort. And there were a lot of people in the store, so I guess I went on an ego trip and decided I might as well put myself in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really worked out rather nicely because I get letters from children wanting to know what I look like if I'll send them a photograph. And I refer them to that picture because I can't send photographs to all the children that want them.
I think that's a fine idea. You've also brought out your family and friends in the dedications that you make for various books.
Yes.
Who have you covered by now?
Well, I've tried to cover only children, but I haven't been able quite to do that. I did dedicate a book to my mother and father, and to Miss Mary Rose Kraft, who has been almost a member of our family, living with us for so long, since I was 3 years old, actually. And then a very dear friend of mine in Chicago, two friends there, a man and wife I've known and loved for a long time. But I really don't approve of dedicating books, children's books, to adults. I'll probably continue to do it, though.
Well, if you continue to write enough of them, pretty soon you will have taken up all of your friends and family, and then you can dedicate to whomever you please.
I have dedicated the three books to my three children. And when the first Obadiah was published, going to be published, I decided to give this to dedicate this to my son Jonathan. Is there time left?
Okay.
And Jonathan was 8 years old at the time. The other two children had gotten away from me. They were beyond children's picture books at this point. So I was going to surprise Jonathan and give him the first copy, let him get the thrill of seeing his name in the dedication page. But just to be sure he was impressed, I questioned him about dedications some weeks, if not months, before the book was published. I asked him if he knew what a dedication was, and he said he didn't, so I explained it to him in detail. And then I spilled the beans. I said, Jonathan, when Obadiah the Bold is published, I said there will be copies in every library, in every state, in every city in this country. I really thought that might be true at the time. I said there will be thousands of books published, and every book will have your name in it because I'm going to dedicate it to you. Jonathan said, okay, Daddy, I don't mind.
Oh! Well, it was nice of him to give you that permission, wasn't it?
Well, he wasn't going to stand in my way.
Let's talk a bit about some other things that have been included in your books that if people didn't know, for instance, you and didn't know that you were standing in the book, The Sky Dog, they might not also recognize a bit of satire that you've included in the Poor Richard story. Do you want to explain that?
Yes. Now, this was illustrated a year and a half ago, or perhaps almost 2 years ago. And in this book is included some of the aphorisms of Poor Richard in France. Little Benny talks about his grandfather in admiring terms, and he tells about his grandfather having written this book, and he said he wrote in it, he wrote such aphorisms as, a penny saved is a penny earned, a rotten apple spoils the lot, and another one I forget, A Sleeping Fox Catches No Poultry, and Honesty is the Best Policy. Now, I decided to illustrate these with rather amusing drawings. I was a little concerned about honesty in high places at this point because it looked to me like there was a lack of it, and a rather enormous lack of it. So if you look carefully in this book, you might notice that the culprit in the stocks illustrating honesty as the best policy has the face of an ex-president on it.
I see. And for those who want to search that out in the book, it's on page 6.
It hasn't been widely recognized, and I don't know whether Mr. Nixon has seen it. I rather doubt it.
I rather doubt it, too, but it is there for posterity, certainly. About the artwork that you do, you work primarily in watercolors?
It depends. Since color illustration is so very expensive to reproduce, editors and publishers like very much to have books done in any other way possible. The books I have done in full color are certainly the Obadiah books, and that is done with watercolor and line, the line being a pencil line, but it's a charcoal pencil. Other times, it's a little complicated to explain, but the color has to be separated. And a book called Sky Dog, for instance, has four colors, a blue and a black and a tan and an orange. For every one of those colors, I had to make a special drawing, and they had to be fitted together, registered together. It looks like it might have been done all in one, but it has to be done separately by the artist. Other books, like the Ben Franklin book, Poor Richard in France, were done, that was a two-color again, but they were done with crayons, with charcoal crayons, on a separate drawing for each, for the buff and for the black.
What about the book Fiddler of High Lonesome?
That was done, I don't know that I'll ever do another book like that, because it was very odd and rather difficult to do. I did it in something called gouache. Now, gouache is a, gesso. I'm sorry. It was done with gouache on a gesso panel. What this means is that I have taken drawing board and covered it with a plaster, a very thin coating of plaster, and on that plaster I have put in opaque colors the painting. These paintings really were done in black and white, but it was printed in a bluish color and a black together, called a duotone, to get a sort of a mysterious night quality. So, mm-hmm. So much of it is at night.
And a softness to it, too. Yes. Interesting.
I try to do each book a little differently, because I think each story is differently and requires a different approach. Now, the three Obadiah books, I wanted to look similar. And they are the only ones that have been consistently, I've tried to be consistent with.
Mm-hmm. And they were very colorful books.
Yes.
And there you did not have to do the color separations. That was done
right by
the camera.
Yes, but the most colorful book I ever illustrated, and I don't know if there's a copy here, is a book called Sea is for Circus. And it was done as brilliantly as I could possibly make it, and it was separated, each of the four colors, red, blue, and yellow, and black, were so brilliant. The red was even a fluorescent ink to give it even a brighter punch. And I wanted this to be as loud and blaring as a brass band.
And as a
comes
circus.
Out as, yes, a circus. And no other book I've ever done remotely resembles it.
Hmm. Let's check that out. You happen to be in Alliance today, Britton, because you have been traveling to speak at seminars, have you not?
Yes. One seminar at the State University of Montana. There was a writer's workshop there, and a children's literature workshop. So once getting out there, being out there, I spent some time on the ranch, at a fine time.
And you are stopping in Alliance to visit your family?
That's right. And every time I have the opportunity to come by and stay for a while.
Yes.
And get reacquainted with the city.
Yes, and you are on your way back to your home. Where
back
do
to New York City.
New York City, and you live where in New York City?
Right in the middle of New York City on East 15th Street.
A true city dweller.
Yes, not very happy about it, but that's the way it is.
Well, in New York, you would have the greatest accessibility to the publishing industry. Is
that's
this not
true,
so?
And also for research, again. If you can't find it in New York, A lot of things I know are there, only I can't always track them down. For instance, the Poor Richard in France, I wanted to get an idea of what the hold of a ship would be like, where the cabin that Benny and his grandfather Ben lived in on their voyage. I thought the ship, there'd be a picture of the ship somewhere, and I think the ship is called the Enterprise or something.
We were talking about the research that you had done for your book, Poor Richard in France, and about finding a picture or a description of the ship.
Yes, it's oh yes. If the ship was called the Reprisal, and I did an enormous amount of chasing around New York trying to find pictures of the ship. I found none. I found that it was a brig, and I got pictures of brigs, but I could find no picture of what the cabin or the hold would look like. I really was climbing the walls over this one. I went to, first of all, to the public library. I looked up in old records of ships. I found nothing, no illustrations at all to go by. I went down to the South Street Seaport Museum in New York, but their research was all on steamships down there, early steamships, but that wouldn't do. And I went to the Seamen's and Sailors Institute down by the Battery there, where they had a library, and found nothing there, and finally settled for some pictures of the insides of the Constitution, no, of old, yeah, Old Ironsides.
Oh yes, the U.S. Constitution.
Also, Nelson's ship. I've got the name of that, my history is not as good as it should be. But these, of course, were huge ships, they were warships, and I simply had to adapt those, make them small as I could, trying to remember that this would be a very cramped little vessel. And I made it up in the end, feeling this was not at all satisfactory. A year later, talking to another author and artist of children's books, Peter Speer, told him what a time I had. He said, oh, if you would come to me, I have all the information you would need on that.
Oh.
This is always happening. I'm finding a year or two later things that I couldn't find at the time. But I didn't know Peter Speer at the time, and he wouldn't have known that he had this, that this happened to be a specialty of his.
Oh, well, it's just amazing that I think authors and illustrators go to this trouble to be as exact as they could. And certainly you went to a great deal of trouble in your research, and you did the best you could.
Once, working on The Magic of Millicent Musgrave, which I decided was going to be in 1905, went to a great deal of trouble getting the costumes of that period, all the information for that period. And although it's a fantasy, I wanted it all to be accurate. I did a lot of research and sketching of costumes, and a friend was in the studio and said, why on earth do you go to all this trouble? Because no child would know the difference, and that's quite true. There would be no child who would be able to say this dress is really 1910 or 1890. Perhaps most young parents wouldn't know, but I would know, and that's the important thing.
And in a way, it wouldn't be truthful, would it?
Well, that's it.
It's a matter of having
respect. You try to get it as truthful as possible. I have not been truthful in one area, and I'm very, very sorry about this, but it was because I didn't know that the first Obadiah book has the family going to meeting in a large tree-lined street.
Yes.
And in 1805, there were only tiny little trees, if any. It was practically bare. And I didn't know that until much later.
Oh, my.
That haunts me, but there's nothing I can do about it now.
Well, it's there for everyone to see, and it certainly is a beautiful tree-lined street.
It's the way Nantucket is now, but it is not the way it was in 1805.
Well, we're so pleased that you could come and be with us today and to take time out to do this tape, and we wish you a safe journey home.
Thank you.
And a quick return.
Thank you very much.